No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We've got a special guest tonight, but first let me say hello to my lovely and talented co-host, Maria Sanchez. Maria, how are you?
I'm excellent, Michael, and I always giggle a little wondering how next you introduce me, because you seem to be creative each and every week, so thank you.
Well, you're just such an incredible person. You're so deep. There are thousands of ways to introduce you, and they're all pretty good ways, too. First, let's start with, we have another co-signer, and this one's really, really important co-signer. Steny Hoyer signed on to the bill after years of not being lukewarm to D.C. statehood. He's always been a supporter of the District of Columbia, but not necessarily statehood. So we've got the majority leader, Steny Hoyer, signed on, which gives us 206 co-sponsors on the bill. And that's really great. It's more than we've ever had in the House. We're going to have a hearing on July 24th, so that's big statehood news. And Steny is he's just the greatest guy. You know, the first time I ever met him, he was in his pajamas and slippers. I once went out with a woman whose son and his daughter were best friends, and we brought him home after a dance one night, and he answered the door, and there he was in his slippers.
I thought you were going to say he was emulating Hugh Hefner.
No, and this was 35 years ago, I guess, and I'm like, dang, congressmen are regular people, you know? So thank you, Steny.
Michael, one second. Why do you think he decided to sign now? What was the turning point?
He did an editorial in the Washington Post, which basically said that he had finally been convinced. And we want to talk to our guest tonight, Johnny Barnes, about that, because Johnny also tells a story about how he was not a statehood supporter at first. And Steny's editorial really sounded eerily like Johnny's story, that they had a different idea for the District of Columbia, but the more they thought about it, the more convinced they were the statehood was the way. So with no further delay, let's get Johnny on and talk about that. Maybe he can give us some insights. Mr. Barnes, are you there? Johnny Barnes.
And Maria, and looking forward to an interesting exchange. Let me say first, Senator, that I think using Sweet Honey on the Rock as an opening performance is a good omen, because they have been involved through song on so many movements in the District of Columbia over the years. So I think that's a good omen.
Well, thanks. Huh. You know, someday we're going to have to play the whole song, because of all the music and art that I've ever encountered in this movement, that song really tells the story of the struggle for D.C. statehood. I mean, it's really, really the whole song. If you listen to the whole song, It's just an incredible song, which really outlines the movement. And you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir when I'm talking to you, Mr. Barnes, but I love Sweet Honey in the Rock as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. That song is captivating and has a deep message. And again, Sweet Honey in the Rock has been so involved over the years that it shows that things are really coming together when they sign up along with us for this movement.
I didn't know that. Well, thank you for sharing that history.
Yes. Yes.
Well, and you know what? Let's start there, because you just had the first annual film festival, and you know, these are, I think there's two elements that are missing from our movement, and one is the one that you've embraced here in art and music and theater, which has always been a part of civil rights movements, and the other one, unfortunately for me, is the church. I've tried two important elements, right, in the civil rights movement that are not as active in D.C. But let's talk about the film festival. It was great. First of all, it was great fun. And second of all, it was really well put together. So what gave you the inspiration to do this, Mr. Barnes?
Well, there have been short films put together by you and others over the years, Michael. Some people have seen them, most have not. And they're so good, so inspiring, so stimulating, so educational, so well put together, so entertaining. And it just occurred to me that even the folks who are active DC statehood participants haven't seen a collection of these films. And we ought to expose them to those films, and that was one purpose. The second purpose is to see how these films affect people when they see them. What's the best way to get the message across? And certainly music has been a part of every movement in America from the beginning of the revolution. There's always been music. You don't have a movement without music. The battle hymn of the Republic. We ended a war in Vietnam. All we're saying is give peace a chance. And of course, the civil rights movement. Music is always at the center. You can't think of any movement without music. And so many of these films have music sort of undergirding the message. And so I thought it was a perfect opportunity to show through audio and visual what D.C. statehood is all about, and then to have judges to help us determine what's the best way to get that message across, to get people tapping their feet and opening their minds about D.C. statehood. And of course, some of the most powerful images in America is presented through film. You know, everybody goes to the movies and watches television, and so I wanted a way for people to have an opportunity to see what the talented people, including yourself, Senator, in Washington, D.C., have been doing to try to explain this very simple yet complex message that we're the only people in the world who live in the capital and don't have the same rights as everybody else. No other place is like that in the world except Washington, D.C. And it's really a shame. It's a blight on our democracy that we go out and try to extend the parameters of democracy around the world, yet they come to a screeching halt right in our own backyard. So film is the way to help get that message across. And it doesn't matter what age or what demographic, film will help you understand why it's so urgent and so compelling.
Wow, yeah, that's beautifully said.
and I've always wondered why we don't get more of that, you know, because I think it is a really interesting, you know, in addition to it being, you know, a blight on the poor 700,000 residents of the District of Columbia, it's also a very interesting anomaly that we're, as you point out, the only country in the world that does this. And I don't know why we've never been able to interest, you know, like a major filmmaker or a major documentarian to do a film about this, because it really is, you know, we are unique in the world, and people are always stunned when we tell them about them. When I go to Europe, I've been to Europe a couple of times now to speak at an international conference, and they're always stunned by this, that we're in this situation,
And Michael, you alluded to this. Excuse me, Mr. Barnes. I just wanted to ask you if you could share your journey to the realization that statehood is for D.C. What was your path?
Well, I was born and raised in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and I was a Cub Scout, a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout, and then I donned the uniform of the United States Army as a combat engineer officer, regular Army, which is career path, and I bought into the platitudes that were served upon us in all those institutions and in school, that every person has the right to fully participate in our government. One person, one vote. And then I came to Washington, D.C. For law school and crossed this invisible line in the shadow of the Washington Monument, in the shadow of Lincoln's presence and Washington's presence and Jefferson's presence, and realized that all of a sudden I had left my rights outside of the border. I could no longer participate like everybody else could. I'd done everything. I'd borne every burden of citizenship that is sometimes expected of us, and had done that willingly and voluntarily and freely. And my rights came to a screeching halt. And I said, why? Why? And immediately, I joined this effort to mend the crack in the Liberty Bell through which 700,000 people have fallen. Immediately, I became active to try to correct this mistake of history, because it made no sense to me, none whatsoever. How can you talk about freedom and democracy and justice and then deny it to 750,000 people who do everything that everybody else does except participate in government? It made no sense to me. It really didn't. Everything I'd learned since a child, that denial went counter to that. So that was my journey. I got here and I was shocked. I have to tell you, I was wholly shocked. Because living in Indiana and going to school in Ohio, I didn't realize that the District of Columbia, you know, I knew the District of Columbia was not a state. I knew it was a creation for the, you know, primarily at the outset for the federal government. But I had no idea that the people were treated the way we're treated. Mm-hmm. So I immediately joined that crusade and have been doing it ever since. So it dates back to 1970.
Wow.
Well, and you know, and let me tell you that Johnny Barnes is still an Eagle Scout. He still takes on all sorts of challenges, and we're going to talk to him in a minute about what he's doing in court. And let me also tell you that for years, Mr. Barnes was head of the ACLU in Washington, D.C. So he was in front of lots and lots of good causes in the District of Columbia. And we miss him as head of, or I personally, let me not speak for all Washingtonians, but I certainly miss him as head of the ACLU because unfortunately they're not as engaged with us as they used to be in this fight. But tell us what you're doing now, Johnny. I know you're talking about a court case. Do you actually have something in court, or is this something that you're anticipating?
Well, as you know, Senator, what I said at the film festival is that I'm not waiting anymore. I'm just not going to wait anymore. We've waited too long, and we've been patient for too long. And I believe there's a way to resolve this issue in the court. I did also say that because of the work of Congresswoman Norton and Senator Carper, that I think it's only fair to give them a chance, this Congress, to complete the effort, the very strong efforts that's currently underway, with 206 co-sponsors in the House and 30 co-sponsors in the Senate and hearings coming up, that I won't file any lawsuit until they have a chance, this Congress, to complete their effort. But I do think that we have a basis for a lawsuit founded in the Constitution and in law, and I think it's a strong concept. And basically, if you transcend the muddy waters of history, we have come to learn that those who came before us in Washington, D.C., agreed with the federal government to surrender our rights. We voted for president and vice president, senators, representatives, Congress, members of Congress, local elected government. We did all of that before Congress moved here in 1890. And Congress wanted so badly to take total control over Washington, D.C., that it encouraged the people who lived here to agree to surrender our rights. And this is found in the legislative history on many occasions. And in exchange for surrendering our rights to do those things, they promised to house all federal agencies in Washington, D.C. So, all that glitters ain't gold. We gave up our rights for the bounty that was expected, for the commerce that was expected to flow as a result of Washington, D.C. being the nation's capital. And it did. And for a while, Congress adhered to its promise. And then in time, it started to move agencies outside of Washington, D.C., the NIH, the Pentagon, the CIA, and then further and further. And California now has more federal employees than we do. Texas has more. Virginia has more. So Washington, D.C. is no longer Washington, D.C. In fact, the top 120 jobs in Washington, D.C. in terms of pay and power belongs to people who live in Virginia. We're no longer the nation's capital, so to speak. We have 700,000 tax-paying, soldiering people who fight and die in wars like everybody else and pay taxes like everybody else. We're larger than two states, close in population to 10 states. And so that promise that was made to us has been breached. It's a count in a lawsuit that sounds in contract. When a promise is made, mutual promises are made between two parties, and one party fails to fulfill its promise, then the other party has a right to rescind the contract. We can say we're no longer bound by the contract. We want our rights back. That's count one of the lawsuit. Count two of the lawsuit is in the fact that in every treaty to which the United States is a party. They sign on the dotted line. And Tim Cooper, as you know, Senator, has done a lot of work on this with the United Nations. Every treaty to which the United States is a party, we promise to treat the people of our capital city equally to everybody else. And so we are in breach, we're in non-compliance of all of those treaties that we sign pretending to be democratic for Washington, D.C., and we're not. Those are the two main counts. There are others, but those, I believe, are strong accounts. I had thought it would be a good symbol to file it when they try to move the FBI building out of Washington, D.C. But when Trump came in, all of those plans changed. So I'm happy to wait to see if Norton and Carper can get the votes we need. And I know the problem is the Republican Party, and I hope we'll talk about that a little bit later. I also want to talk about Senator Carper, who, when he was a congressman, and how we were greeted in Delaware when we took a train ride to Philadelphia to emphasize the absence of D.C. statehood. But that's essentially the lawsuit. But we're going to wait, give them a chance, and then if nothing happens this Congress, we're going to file what I think will be an effective lawsuit.
It sure sounds that way. I mean, it's practical and logical, what you just outlined.
Yeah, and you know what we would do is we would likely file it in another circuit other than the D.C. circuit, just as the ACLU, Senator mentioned that I've been, that for 10 years I was the executive director of the D.C. ACLU. Just as the ACLU often goes to the Ninth Circuit, at the film festival, we had a former federal judge from Maryland. We could go into federal court in Maryland because Ward 9, Senator, is in Maryland.
Yeah,
people have fled to Maryland, Prince George's County especially, because that's the only way they could get full representation. And so we could get plaintiffs out of Maryland, former D.C. residents, who left so they could be whole Americans and file a lawsuit in Maryland. Or the Ninth Circuit, but this former federal judge from Maryland said he thought the counts that I mentioned made a lot of sense and he would have happily received us in his court. He's now retired, but the fact that a federal judge said that is encouraging.
Well, and we not only is Maryland where we came from originally, since we've given, most people know that the District of Columbia was made up of land given to us by Maryland and Virginia, but then those people in Virginia took their land back when they were afraid that we were going to end slavery, which we actually did. District's the first place. It's almost ironic that we're the first place to end slavery in the United States, and we're still not free. But let me ask you a question, something that really bothered me that Charles Moreland said at your film festival. Charles Moreland is the first representative elected for the District of Columbia. He's a colleague, former colleague of Johnny's. And he said that Johnny worked for our first representative to Congress, well, not our first, but the first modern representative to Congress, Reverend Fauntleroy. And Charles said that when you guys worked for Fauntleroy, you felt like you were there. You know, there was a point at which you thought it was going to happen, that we were going to get our full rights. And, you know, and that's what's going on today, too. Everybody's talking like it's going to happen. And I worry about that because we've been here so many times and we've talked so many times. We talked about it in 2009 when we thought the Voting Rights Act was going to pass. And something always happens. So how do you feel? Do you feel like, we're there again, or is it like Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again?
Well, you know, Senator, let me give Maria a chance to comment if she wants to, but then I'll jump in there.
I just, coming from California, and I'm in bed in the one of the bluest states, and the fact that, like the senator said, most people don't understand. It doesn't make sense. So we just make an assumption that that can't be. Like, no, that can't be. And then we move forward. But being involved with the center around this program now for years, I'm always astounded why there isn't more indignation and anger. It just seems that people have gotten pacifistic about it.
Yes. But, you know, Maria and Senator, I can smell it. I can taste it. We are so, so close this time. Ooh. And Charlie Moreland, as the senator pointed out, reminded us that back in 1978, we passed the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment in the Congress by supermajorities, two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate. And with D.C. statehood, we only need a simple majority. We got supermajorities for the idea that D.C. would have two senators, representatives, and proportionate representation in the Electoral College, which is so important given Trump's election, because Secretary Clinton won the popular vote, but Mr. Trump won the Electoral College. So the Electoral College is very important. We passed a proposed amendment to the Constitution with Democrats and Republicans. And the only reason we don't have senators sitting in the Russell Building and the Hart Building today is because we couldn't get three-fourths of the states. Any proposed amendment to the Constitution requires ratification by 38 states. We got, and you have to get the both houses of each state in the same year. So we would get the Pennsylvania Senate one year and couldn't get the Pennsylvania House. And then the next year we would get the Pennsylvania House and didn't get the Pennsylvania Senate. It was the same burden that faced the Equal Rights Amendment for women. They had 7 years to get it done, and we have 7 years to get it done. So we never got the 38 states at the same time to ratify the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. But we were very close. And I tell you, we got people to support this notion that D.C. is being treated unfairly. It was first stated some time ago by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Rehnquist. You know, a card-carrying Republican. He said it's too late in our history for continued denial to the people of the District of Columbia of this basic right. And then when we got the right to vote for president after the 23rd Amendment was passed, we voted against, in 1964, we voted against Barry Goldwater of Arizona, who's the very conservative senator running for president on the Republican Party. We voted against them. Then he turned around and voted for us on the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment, more than 10 years later. Strom Thurmond voted with us on the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. We got Bob Dole, who also ran for president on the Republican Party, and he went to the Washington Monument and gave a speech about why we can't continue to deny people this basic right. Howard Baker, senator from Tennessee, who later became Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, he voted with us. So this notion that Republicans don't get it is a myth. We just have to figure out a way to get them to appreciate that if it's going to be two Senate seats, that is not that might go to Democrats, that's not more important than the fact that we fought a war to end the tyranny of taxation without representation. It's really a conservative concept. It's a Tea Party concept. Local control, local power over local matters. We were so close then, Senator. And then after 7 years, when we didn't get to 38 states, we turned to statehood, which is where we should have been in the first place. for D.C. statehood. But the establishment back then supported the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment because they had been working on it for about 75 years. And when I say the establishment, I mean the Board of Trade and Joe Danzanski with Giant Foods and John Hechinger with the Hechinger Company and all of the major players in Washington, D.C., pushed for the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment over D.C. statehood. But D.C. statehood takes lesser of a vote. It's a broader concept. It really puts us on equal footing with everybody else. Once we get it, they can't take it away. And we would be just like everybody else. So we're on the right path. The stars are aligning. We have all these co-sponsors in the House, so many co-sponsors in the Senate. And I just feel that it's in the air. You know, it's the same feeling I had back when we passed the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment, which I happened to draft, by the way, as a staff person on the Hill. I drafted that amendment. It's in the air. You can feel it. It's going to happen. And it's going to happen, I believe, sooner than many expect. No one expected the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment to pass two-thirds of the House. Jim Wright was the speaker at the time. And we couldn't use the ordinary whip system because people like Jack Brooks of Texas, who was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he didn't support it. So we had to use other members of Congress to whip up all the members to vote for the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. So we used like... the congressman from North Carolina who chaired the committee that controlled all the parking spaces and all the offices, who gets what office. And so when they would go to him and say, congressman, I need a parking space closer to my office. I have to walk too far, in the morning when I get in here. He would say, are you going to vote for this D.C. voting rights amendment? So that's how we whipped them up. We used every method we could because they really had no reason in terms of their local politics to be against. It's an easy one. It's an easy vote for somebody from Oklahoma or Colorado or Wyoming or North Carolina or South Carolina because... for the same reason that people don't know about our situation, they don't care if their member votes for it. They're concerned about, cotton and corn and soybeans and peanuts and cows. And so, yeah, vote for them people in Washington, D.C. It's no big deal. No big deal, you know?
Well, let me ask you, because this is... you know, one thing that bothers me is that we're headed in several different directions on this. And let me ask you about something that's just happened here with the city council. The city council has just passed, well, they haven't passed it yet, but they have unanimously co-signed onto a bill that would allow convicted felons who are serving time in jail to vote. Now, there's only two states that allow this. As people that listen to the show know, once we pass a law, it goes up to Capitol Hill and it sits legislative days, depending on what kind of law it is. And it seems to me right now, this is really a bad thing, a bad strategy. Tucker Carlson has already had a show with the co-sponsor of the guy that introduced the bill, and the banner that read that rolled across the bottom of the screen was DC wants rapists and murderers to vote. Now, is this like
While incarcerated.
Now in D.C., when you've done your time, you can get your voting rights back, and that Fine. And I'm not taking a position on the bill one way or the other, to be honest with you. But I think it's really a bad time to have this bill sitting up in Congress when we're about to have the first hearing since 1993 on voting in the district. How do you feel about that, Johnny? Is this, you think this is a mistake, or you
Well,
don't?
Senator, I tell you, we shouldn't have to apologize for our politics, but we should be strategic. And if everybody in government, from the mayor on down through all of the DC council, locked arms with us the way you and others locked arms in that famous photo when you got arrested for DC statehood, you're kneeling in the streets by the Capitol. You know, I look at that photo all the time, Senator. If everybody locked arms with us, because once we're a state, we can do anything we want.
Right.
We
Once
don't
we're a
have to do it
state.
now. But if
Right.
everybody like, I'll tell you a story, because like you say, they use anything they can as an excuse for continued denial of our rights. But
Right.
Doug Moore was a council member when we were working on the DC Voting Rights Amendment. And a tow truck driver was towing his car. And he got in a fight with the tow truck driver. And like like Holyfield, the boxer, or no, like Mike Tyson bit Holyfield, the boxer. He bit the guy on his ear and during the fight.
Oh my
And
God.
so every time I would go to the floor of the House, you could hear the members saying, you better vote against this DC Voting Rights Amendment, because if you don't, no, you better get your tetanus shot, because if this DC Voting Rights Amendment passes, they're going to send Doug Moore up here and he's going to bite all of us. You know, I mean, it little silly stuff like that. They take anything, and that's another reason why, Senator, that I'm waiting on this litigation, because if the court said anything, any small thing that they could, that the detractors and naysayers and opponents of DC statehood could grab hold of and say, well, the court said, you know, that it's a legislative question. And so it's up to us. There ain't no constitutional right to be a state. There ain't no law that says you have to be a state. The court said it's up to us. And we want to keep Washington, D.C. the way it is. So, you know, we don't want to give them any fodder. And so you're right. You're absolutely right. We shouldn't have to apologize for our politics, but we ought to be prudent in the way we approach our politics until we're on equal footing with everybody else. Because, as I said, once we're a state, we can do anything we want, and they can't take it from us.
Right, and there's no logical chain. I hate to interrupt, but there's, you know, I had African Americans stand up and tell me that this is the way the founding fathers wanted it. I've had women stand up and tell me exactly the same thing, and I say to them, "Yes, but they didn't want you to vote either." You know, I mean,
Yeah,
right?
that's
Right.
right. That's right. Women couldn't vote until the 19th Amendment. 18-year-olds could go to war and couldn't vote. Black
Right, couldn't
people
vote.
couldn't vote.
Right.
And
Native Americans couldn't vote.
we fixed all of those things, Senator. We fixed them. And, you know, as I've said in the past, this is the last voting rights effort in America. And we've got to fix it just like we fixed all the others. But, you know, folks don't understand that. And we had Senator Inouye of Hawaii, former senator from Hawaii, testify at hearings back years ago on DC state. And he said as soon as Hawaii became a state, all kinds of good things happened, because there are certain formulas for housing and education and other social services that give states a better slice of the pie than the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth, and the other places that are part of the American political structure, but not states. And, you know, we're talking about the Virgin Islands, of course, and Puerto Rico and Guam and
right.
American Samoa. He said that as soon as Hawaii became a state, they got so much more money from the federal government because of the formulas they use. So people don't think about those practical things. This is where the rubber meets the road. It's not just an academic exercise, although that is the most important. Those, you know, those platitudes we were taught as young people. But it's even more than that. We're losing resources because we're different, and we're different only because of that mistake of history that, you know, when the Pennsylvania militia surrounded the Congress when they were meeting in Philadelphia and they demanded their pay, and Congress did not respond satisfactorily, in other words, they didn't pay them, they surrounded them and kept them under the cloak of, under siege for 2 days, and they had to escape under the cloak of darkness. And that seemingly minor incident capped what was a feeling on the part of Congress. They had to have some place independent of the control of any state and outside of the boundaries of any state. And that's why we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. They passed Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. But it's interesting, Senator, going back to your opening remarks, and then I'll stop. The reason that Steny Hoyer and the whole Maryland delegation and the whole Virginia delegation were leery of D.C. statehood is because of the potential for a commuter tax. Now, mind you, every state in the union can impose a tax where income is earned. 43 major cities impose taxes on income where it's earned. You can't get into New York City without paying. You can't get out of New York City without paying. So it's a commonly acceptable thing, although I don't think Washington, D.C., would do so. But obviously, Steny Hoyer has come to the acceptance that it's more important to treat D.C. right than it is to worry about whether they're going to tax, whether we're going to tax the 700,000 cars that come in here every day and put potholes in our streets and use our police and fire and water and then go home at night and leave nothing behind. You know, we're the DMV, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, are so intertwined now. That's why we call Prince George's County Ward 9. We got 8 wards, and we call Prince George's Ward 9. That is highly unlikely that we would try to impose some sort of commuter tax. And so, and plus our budget, you know, has swollen and it's balanced and we got AAA rating. I mean, you know, there's no reason to fear a commuter tax. And so I think Steny Hoyer is more comfortable now that that would not happen because we depend on Maryland, they depend on us. We depend on Virginia, they depend on us. And we would treat each other respectfully about things like that. So he's comfortable now that that wouldn't and shouldn't be an issue when it comes to the right of everybody to be treated the same.
Except for your points about the wear and tear and the resource expenditure with public works and public safety is also a very realistic example of, I mean, in, you know, California, we pay to go over the Golden Gate Bridge, for example. You know, that's the cost of keeping it alive and well.
Right.
I wouldn't withhold that by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm glad that that was the tipping point, be that as it may, because I am a very liberal Republican, if there is such a thing, Mr. Barnes, and I believe in this because right is right and politics are second. And that's just how I sit on it. Because it's like you're infantilized by the federal government, the District of Columbia. You're not smart enough. You're not wise enough. You're not good enough to do things that other adults can do. So we're going to do it for you.
Exactly. And you know, Maria, the D.C. statehood, in my view, is more Republican than it is Democrat. And, you know, when I was with the ACLU, I used to tell people, the ACLU is a conservative organization. You know, you all say card-carrying ACLU members. That's the, mm-hmm. that's what the Dukakis was stuck with. But the ACLU defends the Constitution and conserves the Bill of Rights more than anybody else. That's how, and you really have to stretch your mind to get inside of the mind of the ACLU. Because when the Nazis wanted to march in Illinois, we defended their right to do so. And we lost 30,000 members, you know, mostly Jewish members who had been victims of the Holocaust. But they didn't understand, how is ACLU defending the Nazis? We defended Rush Limbaugh in his medical privacy situation. We defended Colonel Oliver North when he swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to Congress, and he didn't. And he will, if you ask him today, he will tell you, I put my faith in the ACLU, my family, and God, and not necessarily in that order, you know? D.C. statehood is a conservative Republican notion, far more so than a Democratic notion. And the Republicans ought to be way out front on this idea of making America like everybody else in the world. Can you imagine that there's no other capital in the world that treats its citizens the way we treat ours? We had some Australian legislators testify at a hearing some years ago. And I'm going to butcher the language, but they said it's curious that we modeled our Constitution after America's. If you look at the Australian Constitution, it looks very much like ours. He said, but then when it came to the capital, Canberra, we took care of Canberra. Why doesn't America take care of Washington, D.C.? It's just out of step with the world community. And we got to do this. And Senator, you and I and the rest of us, Maria, we're not going to wait. Going to give Congresswoman Norton and Senator Carper, we took a train to Philadelphia, and we went through Baltimore, and we went through Delaware. And then when we stopped in Philadelphia, we had about 600, 700 people on this train, the D.C. statehood train. We occupied a whole train. And then we threw tea in the water in Philadelphia.
which only improved it.
Yeah, which made it better. We should do the same thing with the Potomac, Michael. But Carper greeted us. He was a congressman. He greeted us in Delaware. And, when I think, and I'm telling this little story because it just reminded me, with Joe Biden had a little, a flare up over his touchy feely kind of thing, which he's done, throughout his career. Nobody ever thought Joe Biden would
was a predator.
Nobody ever dreamed of that, and he's not. But Carper, when I met him, he looks straight into your eyes, and he shakes your hand, and he's very deliberate about it. What's your name? Johnny Brown. Oh, Johnny, yeah, good to see you. And then he keeps holding your hand, and I'm saying, I hope this guy lets my hand go soon. But that's just the way they are in Delaware.
They're your personal space, right?
Right. They're touchy-feely people. And trust me, Carper was far worse than any, and it's not worse in the real sense. I'm just using it sort of to make the point. Far worse than Joe Biden ever was. He just wouldn't let your hand go. And so when the little flare-up with Joe Biden happened, I said, wow, they never met Carper, obviously. But that's the way they are in Delaware. It's just, and we have a right to be different than other places. That's the genius. As somebody said, We're the United States of America, not the divided states of America. Mm. You know, we came together with small states and big states, the North and the South. Even though the slavery question, as you said, Senator, was an issue, the war debts question was an issue. You know, the big states wanted it, and the little states wanted the capital. We all came together, and we said, we're going to be on the River Potomac. We're going to take 67 miles from Maryland and 33 miles from Virginia. We're going to make this the nation's capital, and everybody's going to be happy because we had all the rights everybody else had until we cut that deal after Congress moved here, 10 years after the debate.
Well, first I want to put in a, since we started talking about your film festival, I want to put in a plug for a film that everybody should see, which is exactly what you just talked about, the ACLU's fight in Illinois. It's a film called Skokie. It was produced by the Hallmark Hall of Fame people, and it's just an amazing, and it deals with exactly that, the ACLU's defense of the Nazi Party in that famous demonstration. I don't want to give away the ending, but the ending of the film is just amazing in what really happened in that case.
Yep.
We're running out of time here, Mr. Barnes, so tell us, are we on the, you think we're on the right path here? We're going to have our hearing. We've got to get people to that hearing. And you think this is it for us? Do you think we really, once we get the House to pass it, which I think will happen, I think you're absolutely right. I think that it will, after the hearing, it'll come to a floor vote. We've got 206 co-sponsors. We only need 12 more. I think it'll pass it in the House. Then what's our strategy in the Senate? Can you give us your take on that?
I think we need to do, and there's one Republican, Maria, who has stood up for impeachment of Mr. Trump. Mm-hmm. I agree with the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
We should not be dwelling on that right now. That's, you know, but all we need is one Republican. Let me tell you, when we did the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment, as I said, Senator, I came on staff with Mr. Fauntroy, and they gave me that legislative responsibility because nobody on his staff or anywhere believed that it would ever pass. 9 months later, we passed through two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate. There wasn't one Republican on the bill to start with, and John Buchanan of Alabama co-sponsored the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. And once he co-sponsored, the dominoes started to fall. The chairman of House, the majority leader in the House Judiciary co-sponsored. He was from Illinois. And I can tell you how we got all these people, but I'll tell you how we got John Buchanan. John Buchanan, Republican from Alabama, of all places, was the first Republican to co-sponsor. And that's because they had a prayer breakfast that met in the House of Representatives, and they were Democrats and Republicans. And they would pray together and, you know, praise the Lord and all of that. And Fauntroy would always hold John Buchanan's hand when they prayed. And then he would tell him, "It ain't right, John. The Lord don't like," you know.
Right.
I'm telling you, they did it through prayer. And finally, John Buchanan said, "Oh, you're right, Walter. I'm going to co-sponsor this young thing." And so then the dominoes started to fall. All we need is one senator. I can taste it. I can
see
it.
Well, we're working on them.
Yeah, I know you are, Senator. I know you. And that's why I'm just, don't give up. Who would have thought that Strom Thurmond would support D.C. voting rights? But let me just finish my point. So we're so close. There is an arcane rule in the Senate, okay? Once the Once the House passes the bill, and I agree with you, it's going to pass the House. We only need 218, a simple majority. Once we get 218 people to say yes to D.C. statehood, and I always ask my students, who runs the Congress? The clerk of the House, one of the clerks of the House, will physically take the enrolled bill over to the Senate. He'll walk it over there, and they do the old English thing, and he bows and bows and bows. It's a formal thing. And then he hands it to the clerk of the Senate. Any one senator can step between them and take the bill and put it directly on the Senate calendar, bypass the committees, and say, we're going to vote on this bill. Any one senator can do that. Birch Bayh of Indiana did it for us with the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. Once it's on the calendar, they have to vote for it. And I tell you, Senator, that a lot of these senators would be hard-pressed to vote against it. So if we get one Republican, the dominoes will fall, and then if we get one senator to take the bill when it passes the House from the clerk and place it directly on the Senate calendar, we're on our way. And that's what happened when we passed the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. It's an arcane rule. Now, I will tell you a little quick story. I know we're running out of time. Senator Eastland of Mississippi happened to be a Democrat. He was the chairman of Senate Judiciary back when we passed the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. I went over to see his chief of staff because we knew he was upset that we had taken the bill and you know, went around his committee. So his chief of staff was dressed in all white, so stereotypical. White jacket, white shirt, white pants, white patent leather shoes, white socks. He was dressed in all white. And I went over there to see him, and I said, I have an appointment with you. He said, the senator going to see you now. I said, the senator going to see you now. So Eastland called. I went in to see Eastland, and he said, Well, you know, I know the House passed this year thing. You want the Senate to pass it. If the Supreme Court go along with it, if all the states go along with it, I might go along with it. And I said, well, Senator, we don't need, I know what we need and what we don't need, but that's what's going to have to happen before you get me to go along with it. And I said, well, I was funny. He said, you didn't waste your time coming over here, did you? Then he said, and I tell you the other thing, have you heard about the motion I'm going to make to commit the bill back to my committee? And I said, well, Senator, we would hope, have you heard about it, though? I said, no, we haven't heard about it. Well, you didn't waste your time coming over here, did you? Okay, you excuse, young man. And you know what, though, Senator? Yeah. He didn't put that motion to recommit back to committee. And he didn't vote against it. He didn't vote for it. But he took a walk on the day we had to vote, and we wouldn't have got a pure two-thirds of the Senate if he had voted no. He couldn't bring himself to vote yes, but he did not vote no. He took a walk. And I tell you, you never give up. I don't give up on anybody in the Senate, especially Republicans.
Because, that's a story.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. You know, you would be surprised. It's etched. They were Cub Scouts and Girl Scouts.
Right.
They were, you know, Boy Scouts and members of the 4-H. They got the same lessons we got.
Yeah.
That you don't treat people differently in America. That's what we're about. And they got those messages. And I believe that if we get a few Republicans, the dominoes will fall. We only need to start with one. And when they're faced with the question of, do you want to be different than the rest of the world, they'll hold their noses and do the right thing. They did it by two-thirds in the House and two-thirds in the Senate, and they'll do it for D.C. statehood. I can taste it. I can smell it. We're there, Senator. Trust me. We're there.
All right. And on that note, we have to end. But thank you, Johnny Barnes.
Play that Sweet Honey in the Rock as we go.
Well, you know what? We've got another song for you. Because a hero of mine died this week. I'm very into music, and New Orleans jazz is very important to me. Dr. John passed away this. So we're going to play one for Dr. John, for Mr. Johnny, because Johnny Barnes is a hero of mine. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, and thank you, Maria.
Thank you for all you do. What an inspiration.
And we'll
talk to our listeners. Yes.
Yep. Thanks, Maria.
Thank you, Senator. Give the people their right to vote.